Support for MPB comes from the Mississippi Museum of Art in Jackson. What Became of Dr. Smith by artist Noah Satterstrom is on view beginning April 20th. Learn more at msmuseumart.org.
This podcast is a local production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting and depends on the support of listeners like you. If you can, please donate today at mpbonline.org. And thanks.
Welcome to the Mississippi Arts Hour. This is Sarah Story, the Executive Director of the Mississippi Arts Commission. Today, we are talking with Claire Whitehurst, a painter, printmaker, and ceramicist living and working in Mississippi. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're so excited that you're here today, and we can't wait to hear more about you and your life full of art creation and teaching. You're also teaching right now. So let's start there. Let's talk, just hear a few words from you about what you're doing now and where you are located in the state.
Okay. I'm in Jackson, or in Ridgeland, I guess, outside of Jackson, at teaching at St. Andrew's Episcopal School. I am the upper school art teacher. There are two of us. I work with Emmy Sprayberry, who's also an artist. And I teach art studio, AP studio, AP art history, ceramics, and then I'm in charge of the yearbook too. So there's a lot of hats here. I actually just got done teaching an AP art history class where we were talking about the Renaissance and Sistine Chapel and the School of Athens and all that kind of stuff. So, and then I'm also an artist full-time outside of school. I work across painting, printmaking, and ceramics. And it's a lot going on right now. I've never been this busy, but it's really good. And it feels really good to be back in Mississippi for me at the moment. I just graduated in 2020 from the University of Iowa with degrees in painting, printmaking, and ceramics. So, I'm just living that post-grad life of trying to figure out where I am and what I want to do and, you know, how to move around those things.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, we're glad that you're back. And I know that St. Andrews and the students are glad to have you over there. I can't wait to get into all that, especially life after grad school. I know that's a transition in any field, but especially a field of arts where there's literally no clear path written out for anyone in the arts.
You throw in a global pandemic and that.
It complicates things. So we'll get to that in a little bit, but let's start off by talking a little bit more about your background. Where'd you grow up? Let's start there.
I was born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and my parents are both from Louisiana. My dad's from New Orleans, and my mom's from little town Ruston outside of Monroe in North Louisiana. And I was born in Baton Rouge, and then we moved to Jackson around the year 2000. So yeah, I grew up kind of between two places. I've always loved Louisiana and feel like that's where I'm from, but also contend with Mississippi. You know, it's not geographically very far away, but it's very, I think plants and plant life, both my parents are scientists adjacent, and my mom's an infectious disease doctor, and my dad is an environmental lawyer, but he was originally a marine biologist. So I had this two parents who were acutely aware of the natural world. And so a lot of my time was spent outside just looking at things. And I think that was what was so different for me, Louisiana, and where I was in South Louisiana and, you know, Central Mississippi are very different ecologically, not too dramatic, but I love swamps. I love the dramatic weather. Just, it was a lot to be in as a child. So,
yeah, it's very diverse too. just the amount of different wildlife and plants, et cetera, that you can find in a place like Louisiana where there is swampland, because that's so unique to most of the rest of the country.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, really just kind of spending, I spent the majority of time outside. Hated wearing clothes. I feel like it's a common Mississippi or Southern kind of picture of children playing in mud, but that's what I really did. And I think I think my work centers itself around childlike observation. I think to look at something is to abstract it, and that's kind of the avenue where I see my work, where I come up with my images, because it's heavily, heavily observed, and it's just looking really hard at things and imagining what it would be like if they were different, and kind of that obscuring something through examining what it is. And I did that as a kid too. I remember covering myself in mud and being naked outside on concrete sidewalks and in a backyard. It wasn't in public, but I would grind up chalk, like sidewalk chalk, into a paste, and I would like cover myself in it. And I think that's still kind of how I paint, not literally, but that's that love of material. I've always been a very tactile, like, sensory oriented person and artist, I think. So I'm interested in enveloping myself in the way that things feel and look. So, you know, sometimes people say my work reminds them of children's art, and I take it as a compliment, but people usually say, I'm sorry.
I think that is a compliment. I mean, was it Picasso that said a quote about,
it took him his whole life to figure out how to draw like a child. He said he was trained like Raphael by the time he was 13, but it took him the rest of his life to figure out how to draw like a child.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's so fascinating. So do you feel like, were you trained and then did you untrain yourself, or have you been able to keep this perspective and a specific process or perspective to your work all along?
I draw from life constantly. I draw people's faces and imagined faces. That was one of the first things I really, I mean, I have, you know, my notebooks from school are covered with just single eyeballs and like the transition from the tear duct down to the nose and where the ear comes in. And so I really love that kind of work, and I love landscape painting. So I really like painting water. Whenever I'm traveling and I know water is going to be near, I'll bring my watercolor and my paper, and I'll use water for the paint from the little, so if I'm by a river, I'll just dip some river water and paint with that. Sometimes it smelled. I've had some like smelly paintings from that, but it's kind of part of it. But I love figuring out how things sit in a two-dimensional space. I just think it's fun. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you create from your child till now? Did you have training in school? How was that journey for you?
Yeah. My mom said that I've always had something in my hand. And I drew all the time. I painted if I could get my hands on it, or I was always kind of fidgeting with something. I was always tearing something up or, you know, arranging things on. I just like touching objects. I just like touching stuff. But then I got really into I loved drawing. I danced ballet when I was younger, and I loved drawing the foot in a pointe shoe. That sticks out in my memory. That's another thing that's in a bunch of my journals, where I love horses, and I would try to figure out how to draw the barrel of their chest and then like going into the hindquarters and their neck. So yeah, like pointe shoes, horses, eyeballs, that kind of stuff was my childhood kind of drawing, and tie-dye, which I still kind of do. But I remember in the 90s, like in early 2000s, tie-dye was big for me.
Oh yeah, get some rubber bands and a white shirt.
Yeah.
It's a good time.
I'm just drawing tie-dye. I really wanted
tie-dye.
I drew tie-dye all the time. Just,
oh wow.
I just thought it was so cool. Like just watching markers lay over each other and how color would change was fascinating. So and then another memory is drawing scientific diagrams of cells, and kind of biology drawings were really fun for me. And that's when I really, really started to draw, around seventh, eighth grade. And then in high school, I did art, and in college, I did art, and then in graduate school, I did art. So it's kind of been nonstop since I was about 10.
That's amazing. Where did you go to undergrad?
I went to the University of Mississippi.
And did you do a BFA? What was your yes. time like there?
I got a BFA in painting, and I worked mainly with Philip Jackson and Sherry Breathe, who were, Philip is the head of painting and Sherry was the head of printmaking. So painting and printmaking and this kind of physical drawing, you know, I always thought of painting and printmaking as a collaboration of drawing and, you know, and color. So I got my BFA there and lived in Oxford for about a year as an artist, as a young little baby artist. I worked at Bottle Tree Bakery, which was very lovely. And Cynthia Gerlach let me hang some of my paintings in Bottle Tree that are still there. And I sold at Double Decker. And then I did a post-bac degree at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philly. And I had always wanted to go there because I did a book report on Mary Cassatt in the seventh grade.
She went
there. And I love her work, but also Walter Anderson went there. So Walter was always a big influence in my life. I think about him all the time, especially as a painter and a printmaker, and his work with ceramics and that lineage surrounding Ocean Springs and the Mississippi Gulf Coast. So.
Yeah, and that's, his process sounds somewhat similar to yours, and just the fascination with nature.
Yeah.
And the ever-changing nature of a particular place and landscape.
Yeah. And the movement. I think a lot of his work is about movement, just the observation of movement.
This is Sarah Story, the Executive Director of the Mississippi Arts Commission. You are listening to the podcast version of the Mississippi Arts Hour. To have access to all Arts Hour interviews, subscribe to the podcast using your favorite podcasting app. You can also listen to the show on MPB Think Radio every Sunday afternoon at 5 p.m.
Hi, I'm Walt Grayson. You can now listen to the wild, weird, and wonderful stories of Mississippi with Mile Marker.
Some of the big names that travel up and down the highways, obviously Elvis and Johnny Cash, and you have Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins.
Join me as we hit the roads of Mississippi on Mile Marker.
Johnny Cash suggested that Carl write a song called Blue Suede Shoes. That was all kind of created with Aaron Amory.
You can listen by going to mpbonline.org/radio or by using your favorite podcasting app.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Welcome back to the Mississippi Arts Hour on MPB Think Radio. This is Sarah Story, Executive Director of the Mississippi Arts Commission. And I have with me today an artist who is currently in Mississippi, Claire Whitehurst.
Hey. So,
hello. So thank you, Claire, again for being here. And right before the break, we were talking about Walter Anderson, one of probably the most well-known artists in Mississippi, I think. Would you agree?
I think so. I think I'm sure you've seen it, the video of him that was probably made in the 70s or 80s is like grilled into my brain because I've watched it so many times. But he's kind of, and I think so much what we were talking about, he is such an observant artist. He was, and I think continues to be, just how documenting the landscape and then I think capturing something else, maybe the surreal or divine within that. And
the order.
I think a lot of
the order and the chaos.
Yeah, yeah. Because that's so much of what we have to contend with here is how to exist in the environment and what it means to take care of it, you know, who has access to it. All these things kind of come together in the environment.
So true. When I was working at the University Museum in Oxford in the education department, I was teaching a lot of students in school groups about Walter Anderson, and his motifs were one of my favorite things to talk about with kids because it was such an interesting way to think about the world in the way that he did, of just dividing everything. Was it 7 motifs that he created out of natural elements? And those represented so much to him. He was able to kind of create his worldview, like almost make his own order and language. And I always found that really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I've been thinking a lot about entropy a lot recently, which is funny because I think that's kind of what his work is about, is how things come together and how things fall apart and what that looks like in the natural world and how that's reflected in societies and, you know, personal relationships and narrative. And it's and I think that's what we look for. I think we look towards the natural world for answers to things that we don't know, and he was good at that. And I think sometimes I just have, because not many people know him outside of the South, which is interesting.
You're right.
And so I lived in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and in Iowa, and spent time in France. I talk about him and I show him to people, and it's such a captured world that he has. You know, it's. I don't know.
Yeah, it's very unique and very specific to a lot of it, at least, is very specific to one little island, which is fascinating. Mm-hmm. Or an island.
Oh, I was going to say, I just have this clear image of him in my head, like strapping himself to a tree during a hurricane. That's just such a powerful image that I've had since I was a little girl. So, and I love Theora Hamlet. This kind of mystical attachment to the natural world too. But I also worked at the Mary Bowie Museum, and
what years were you there? We didn't overlap, did we?
I don't know. I was an intern during college. I helped with archiving.
Oh, okay, cool.
For a brief period of time, but I got to be back there a lot with those movable walls and the stacks and with her work and just see it. And she was also able to capture this kind of the vibrations of the space that she was occupying and observing. I love her work.
Yeah. She was able to capture really simple moments of life in really interesting ways.
Yeah,
you're right. So true. In a very different way than Walter Anderson, but in her own way.
Yeah, also she was always kind of hovering above everything. It was like she was a bird.
Yeah.
All the perspective is very mystic and, you know, spiritual and somehow lifted above. You know, I think a lot of Walter Anderson's work is from the perspective of a human body. Mm. Hers was always in the trees.
Mm.
It's so interesting. And I just love her.
Yeah.
I don't know. And a lot of her inspiration came from visions that would actually, you know, interact with her. She would have a vision and make painting, which has always been fascinating to me.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about, so you were in Mississippi, then you said you were in France, Philadelphia, Iowa. What was that like for you as an artist, changing landscapes, changing cities? Just, I mean, everything in those four different environments are yeah. very, very different from each other.
Yeah, I think I did a studio program for a year at the Academy of the Fine Arts in Philly, and everything got really, I was obsessed with the grid. I was, you know, I read, mm-hmm. you know, Rosalind Krauss and like her ideas about grids, and got really into Agnes Martin and just this idea of the repetition of a contained space. And I think it was because I was in a city and I'd never really lived. I was living in an apartment in downtown Philly, and everything was so grid-like. I was living in a grid. I was living in an apartment shape, you know, it was like a perfect square. The tiles in my bathroom were square. Everything that I saw were like Amazon boxes and people shipping things. And so I just became really enamored with the rectangle. And so I was really interested in how abstraction exists within a rectangle. Because I think my ideas about abstraction were organic and contained rounded shapes and squiggles and things that were contained in the, you know, biology department. But that's kind of what I did there. And then I moved to Iowa, where I was kind of at a loss. I just, you know, it was this big transition into graduate school. My cohort, everyone was so talented and smart, and I was just trying to find my footing and really reading as much as I could, you know, working as much as I could. And then the snow came, you know, in October.
Wow.
Basically until from October, November until April.
Oh my goodness.
So there's this, and that presents an entirely different kind of physical experience of the world. So everything becomes trapped underneath the snow. And I started using the color white all the time. I was making these big plaster pieces. I was making these really kind of looked like little like Golgi apparatus and like mitochondria, like these tiny parts of things that were very vibrant and colorful. And then I would make a mold and pour like stark white ceramic plaster into it and let it set up for about 5 minutes. And then I would press these colorful little pieces in it. And that's kind of how I was seeing the world. And that's what felt true at that moment. So I was making these kind of like snow fields.
Wow.
And I think it was just from walking and being in the snow for, you know, half a year.
Right.
So that affected me in that way. And I spent time in this little village outside of Montignac in the Dordogne region of southern France, studying cave paintings my second summer. The summer after my first year of graduate school.
So oh, wow.
I was a Stanley Fellow at the University of Iowa, and was given funding to live in France for a summer. And I got to visit, I think around 40 different cave sites.
Wow.
I wasn't, you know, Lascaux and Chauvet and the big ones are closed, you know. Werner Herzog only got 10 minutes. I wasn't going to get in there, but
right.
There's hundreds of them around. And I think it was, I was really fascinated, I think, with my work in graduate school with how form, a physical form or a physical surface can inform the image that's created on top of it. So I was making these very touched surfaces and then going to make paintings on top of them. And I had always thought about cave paintings, and that's what they are. It's these incredible tableaus on ancient rock. So I wrote about form and image and the way that those two things interact. And kind of as an investigation, I was proposing that I would go there and study these sites and then make a body of work in response to it, which is what I did. And so I would go, had my little backpack, and I would take my paint and lots of colored pencils. And I would go into these caves that you can't have anything in there, and run out and immediately try to like make something that was
wow
close to what I, which was kind of, it was absolutely intimidating. I knew I wasn't going to get close, but I knew I had to make some kind of mark. I mean, to be, most of the time I was crying. I mean, it was just such an awe, truly awesome experience to be in front of those paintings. But sometimes, and I started thinking and reading and working with people that talked about cave paintings as forms of early animation. And so the way that the rock formations were used to inform the paintings. Sometimes a rock formation would protrude and jut out, and then as you move across, it would become the hindquarters of a bison. And so if you recreate the light source that these people had when they were making, it was an animal fat lamp with a flickering flame. And wow. So as that flickering happens, the pictures actually begin to move from the light hitting the surface. So I was thinking a lot about animation and just how things move. I guess going back to that observation of movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that was overwhelming, you know. There's only so much I could really do because I was taking in so much.
Right.
But, my idea was to create a cave. I drilled holes into the wall and like stuck wooden dowels into the wall and then made these paintings on sheer fabric and then strung those on top of the wooden dowels. So they kind of moved when people walked by.
Wow.
And then I made drawings, but it was incredible. But I think I'm only now, you know, it's still bubbling up through the surface.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
How long was your grad program?
3 years.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. It was incredible. And then, yeah, like being back here, I'm being introduced to all the greens that I hadn't seen. You know, I'm switching out white for green. So green is I forgot how truly diverse the green is in the trees here in the ground. It's just growth all over the place.
This is Sarah Story, the Executive Director of the Mississippi Arts Commission. You are listening to the podcast version of the Mississippi Arts Hour. To have access to all Arts Hour interviews, subscribe to the podcast using your favorite podcasting app. You can also listen to the show on MPB Think Radio every Sunday afternoon at 5 p.m.
Welcome back to the Mississippi Arts Hour. This is Sarah Story, Executive Director of the Mississippi Arts Commission. And I am here today with Claire Whitehurst, a painter,
printmaker and ceramicist living and working in Jackson, Mississippi. So we were talking just before the break about how you were influenced as an artist from your surroundings. So tell us a little bit more about the landscape here and how that's influencing what you're creating now in your studio.
Everywhere else was kind of this, I was learning a new place. So I'm kind of remembering a lot of things. So I think a lot about memory and place and kind of all the things that go into kind of the emotional landscape of a place that you know. Because the last time I was living in Mississippi, you know, I was making my work not in secret, but to myself. But I think part of the way I made money after college, I was painting people's houses and mm-hmm. painting the landscape and painting things that I thought, you know, would sell because I was trying to make money.
Sure. Yeah. Look, we all have been there.
So yeah, I'm kind of like having this incredible opportunity to relearn the landscape, relearn kind of myself as, you know, a person who's living here and my relationships with my family. And I had my first garden over the summer here in Mississippi. I had my first garden in Iowa, which was fine. But, you know, there's a much, much longer growth window in Mississippi for gardens. Right. So I think tending to that little garden gave me so much to think about in terms of memory and place. And plants have always been a big part of my life. And I think I'm realizing that I need that constant interaction for my work too. So I think about the way that leaves are organized and how little sprouts come up and the symmetry of all of that. And I was making these, my most recent body of work, which was just in a show in LA, was about the memory of my childhood, kind of, and then coming back as an adult and as a, you know, professional, educated, you know, freshly out of grad school artist, like trying to make sense of all of that. So a lot of kind of remembered imagery, you know, the smell of tomatoes is like very, very intense for me. And I had a little tomato garden and I would go and take care of them. I would pick the little dead leaves off and, you know, take care of it the way you're supposed to. And then I would go into my studio and kind of make work about, loosely about tomatoes, but about probably a lot of other stuff too. But yeah, relearning and just reobserving the place where I grew up and seeing it with new eyes, with better eyes, you know, is just a constant problem for me to solve. You know, the going back and forth, I think being on, you know, I just haven't lived here in about 12 years. So it's interesting to be a part of it again in a new way.
Yeah, I think that's incredible, the opportunity to rediscover a place after being gone for that long.
Yeah.
Because you is for me at least coming back after about the same amount of time, it's so true. Like so much has changed, but then so much hasn't changed. And so
yeah,
like what do you do with that?
yeah. And it's I use layers a lot, and I think of layers in that kind of in that way too, memory layers of the memory of something versus the reality, or you know what you think of something versus what it actually is. And I think that's kind of my emotional playground when it comes to art, is like how do I translate those kind of really complicated or intangible thoughts into something that's tangible and visual. And so that's kind of what I've been doing. And I've been making drawings, then I've been making a lot of ceramic pieces and then drawings of those ceramic pieces as kind of a jumping off point. But they're very, I have one right here, but I know you can't see it on the radio, but these are very like handled, they look like jungle gyms, going back to an idea of a playground, but kind of really handled things that manipulate the surface, and then how color sits on top of that, and then what it means, I guess, for me right now to observe that and try to make a drawing or a painting of it, and kind of getting lost in that translation of form, I think gives a lot of space for me to think about the concepts that I want to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, does that help you think through memory and the way that we reinterpret something or change something in a new way?
I think so. Yeah. And sometimes, it's just, I need my hands to like babysit my mind.
Yeah.
And then, you know, things come out of it, but that's what I've been doing lately. I'm about to start a new body of work for I have my first big solo show at a gallery in LA called Steve Turner Contemporary, which is such a gift and so exciting and
awesome.
I'm very excited, but I'm working with a friend of mine who makes, a carpenter in Jackson, and he's making me these kind of wooden cage structures that I'm going to wrap linen around. I love linen and like the raw linen. I'm playing around with that, but I'm going to make a body of shaped paintings to kind of combine these drawings that I had been doing over the summer and part of the early fall, and then these more complicated physical structures of the ceramics. I think it'd be interesting to stretch a skin over that and make a painting on top of it. So that's what I'm working on now. It's like a flattened bird cage kind of, but then wrapped.
That's cool.
So we'll see where that goes. It might just be a stepping stone to something else, but
yeah,
that's what I'm thinking of right now.
That's awesome. And what else are you working towards at the moment? So you have that big show. So that'll be mostly 3D, more 3D images or 3D materials.
Yeah. Three-dimensional, but with like 2D, 2-3D. I guess both at the same time.
Cool, yeah.
But I'm working on that. And then I'm working on a show with a good friend of mine named Taylor Lofton, who is an artist in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Originally from Jackson, but he is a good friend over the years. We actually met at Pinland School of Craft years ago. And I've always been such a huge fan of his work. And so we have a two-person show at Binder Projects in Memphis.
Cool.
In January. And it's just been so much fun talking to him and thinking about our work together. But I think I'm going to show a lot of ceramic work in that show, and then the drawings that I've been doing. And he's been making ceramic work too. He works closely with Linda Lopez, who is the head of ceramics at the University of Arkansas, who I am obsessed with her work too. She actually came and visited Iowa while I was there.
Which was great.
I know. It's like all these little connections. It's
awesome.
Insane. And then I'm part of a three-person show in Atlanta in March at Spalding Nick's Fine Art, which I'm very excited about. And then I've been invited to be a guest artist at Watershed Ceramics in Maine over the summer.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So I've been invited by Susan Klein and Suzanne Dittenberg. Might not be saying her last name right, but they're painters from North Carolina. And I'm just really excited. It's about painters who use ceramics in their work and the surfaces. I'm really, really excited for that. And I just published a book with Drum Machine Editions out of Asheville, North Carolina. And It's a book of screen prints that are presented in these mirrored pairs. And it's kind of goes back to this translation of memory through form. And it was a series of drawings I made in the early pandemic, like right as everything was shutting down. And I just wore myself. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what the world was going to look like. It was kind of, everything felt like it was falling apart. So I just drew.
Mm-hmm.
And I just made these drawings, and it was really incredible to be able to make a book with my friend Eric, who runs Dry Machine Editions. He's a wonderful printmaker. He is from, he's from Pennsylvania, but he went to grad school in Tallahassee, Florida, and then moved to North Carolina. And he's a wonderful printmaker. And it was just cool to dissect my images and have somebody help me make them in through a different, you know, matrix, which was, it was just, they changed, you know, they came alive again in this new way. And I got to write about them with him. And his partner is an old friend of mine, Whitney Gilchrist. So I was able to reconnect with my friend and write about my work. And it was just a really great experience. And that came out November 2nd.
Awesome.
So yeah, there's a lot going on.
You've been busy right after grad school. That's awesome. That's so good to hear.
I really did not expect to be, but I'm so great. I mean, it's, you know, I think it was, I didn't know what else to do. And I did it, you know. It all kind of came from having ideas, like kind of silly ideas. And the more I lean into the ideas that I have, I thought for a long time that they were silly, but I don't, maybe they're not. I get to do fun projects with my friends, and yeah, it's been great. And I love teaching too, that my students give me so much energy and perspective and challenge me, and it's fun.
When you're talking about teaching art history, I can imagine that would just be such a delight to be able to revisit so many different periods of art history and just have that time to study again or rediscover different periods and share.
It's such a good, I mean, it's, I can't believe it. Every day I'm just like, I can't believe I get to, you know, teach this content, but then it's also enriching my life and my work in such a profound way. And a lot of the stuff I haven't revisited since in a meaningful academic, you know, app, like looking at it and talking about it or writing about it since I was close to their age, like 18 or 19, freshman year of college in an art history survey.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And to actually be able to interact with the breadth of, you know, I have to cover it all.
Mm-hmm.
In the AP curriculum. So it's really interesting to understand the chronology of, or look at it. I know it's not the whole chronology, but how we did stuff and how we, the more and more I learn about art history is it's really just, it's observation and documentation.
Right.
Who was able to pay which artist for what, and you know, who had the money and who had the land, and you can track a lot of things through art.
And back to your point about memory, we never know what wasn't tracked. You know, there's so much that's missing because of so much of art, like many other things have been driven by power and money, right? So it's interesting to think about that as well.
Yeah. And with power, like most always comes corruption. So like looking at what we have left is also asking why that's what we have left. Like what was destroyed? What was hidden or obscured by the people who are writing the histories of the world. And so that's a really interesting conversation to have with teenagers who, you know, are living in a world that I am a part of, but I wasn't there, you know, age within.
Sure. That's great. Well, thanks so much for sharing all of that. And where can people find you now?
I have a website and an Instagram. So my website is www.clairewhitehurst.com, just one word. And then I have Instagram, which I love. It's such a wonderful tool for artists. It's at @Claire_Downes, D-O-W-N-E-S, which is my middle name, but it's also my Instagram handle. So Claire Downes. And then, yeah, that's kind of where I share all the information about shows and upcoming stuff that I'm doing.
Thanks for listening to this MPB Think Radio podcast. MPB depends on support from listeners, so if you can, please contribute today at mpbonline.org.
On Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit, you get information about foods you should eat to stay in good health and tips on how to stay active. I'm Dr. Josie Bidwell, host of Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit, and Associate Professor of Preventive Medicine at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. Listen to the show every Monday at 11 or subscribe to the podcast by searching for Southern Remedy with your preferred podcasting app.